Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go over to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are going on over there. The weather is nice. Spring is upon us. I don't know why that's the season for podcasts, but it is. You're going to be outside. You're going to start running again. You're going to start doing things out in the outdoors again. And you probably need those podcasts flowing into your ears. And maybe this podcast is not enough. I mean, this is only 40 minutes once a week. You probably need more than that. So I know you need more exercise than that. So, you know, go over to the podcast network and check out what other podcasts you can have flowing into your ears while you're doing stuff. Chad, you know, the when this releases, it'll just be 2 days away from Des Moines. So, I mean, if somebody listens to this right when it comes out and they're in Iowa, they really need to get on it. If they haven't registered for the event or they haven't made plans to come out, it's going to be crunch time for them. You need to make sure your weekend's clear so you can get out there on Saturday to hear Chad talk about plucking out your eye and cutting off your hand and stuff. Scott's going to bring a sword. He's going to be talking about bringing a sword. And then Chad's going to tell you what to do with that sword in regard to your body parts.
It's a very violent city event.
It is. It's the most violent event we've done. So you can go over to the city events page at Christ Old Fast, and you can register. If you're not in the Des Moines area, but you're up in that Minnesota area, we're also going to be up there on May the 4th. So just less than a month later, I'll be there. Scott will be there. Eric Sorensen. Lee Fitzpatrick, Jared C. Wilson. It's going to be a good time. So you have two options if you're in the Midwest to come and hang out. Chad, we are desperately trying to get through Deuteronomy chapter 4. It's apparently the richest book in the entire Bible because we didn't know that, but it is apparently so because we can't get through it.
Yeah, it's like the deeper we wade into Deuteronomy 4, the deeper it goes, but we're gonna plow through. We're gonna jump into chapter 5 because I know that everybody cannot wait to get to Deuteronomy 5.
Yeah, I imagine.
It's like Exodus 20 rebooted, except with a few little changes in the 10 words. So we will get there.
I'm fully devoted to getting through chapter 4 this week.
All right, well let's jump in. So we have spent a significant amount of time here, and hopefully everyone has profited from that, at least to some extent. We're going to pick up with about verse 32 and move forward. Of course, a big theme of the chapter has been the first commandment, especially the prohibition of any images from creation in order to depict the God who has spoken from the midst of the fire. And we see a little bit of that in the rest of the chapter. Although it seems like beginning with verse 32 and following, as Moses is preaching, he's kind of shifting to a little bit different theme. And this particular theme is more or less that God is unlike, the true God is unlike any of the other false gods to which Israel has been exposed and to which they will be exposed when they enter into the land of Canaan. So one of the things that you hear in 32 and following is the supremacy of Yahweh. For example, in verse 34, it says, has any God tried to go to take for himself a nation from within another nation by trials, by signs and wonders and by war and by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm and by great terror? So there's like this long laundry list of the means that God used to bring his people out of Egypt. So has any God tried that as the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? And of course, all of these are rhetorical questions. No, the God has done that. And implicit in this verse 34 is that God did this and the Egyptian gods were unable to stop him because, of course, they are nothing more than not existent deities. They're gods in name only. And then, but he's not done. He goes on to talk about how there is no God besides him. He lets you hear his voice out of the heavens, and on earth he lets you see the great fire. And verse 37, he says, because he loved your fathers, for that reason, he chose their descendants after them, and he personally brought you from Egypt by his great power. That word personally, by the way, in Hebrew is literally, it's by his face. So He was face first, if you will. His presence was there leading Israel out of Egypt and driving out the nations that were greater and mightier than Israel. So, in other words, after really focusing upon the first commandment, the necessity of having one God and worshiping one God and not depicting this God and through any sort of earthly images, he goes on to talk about how distinct this true God is from all the false gods by a description of what he has done for Israel. And this is certainly a prominent theme that you have in the Old Testament. God is rarely described in any sort of what we would call abstract or philosophical terminology. He's usually described by means of what he does. So who he is described by what he does. And we see this already back in Genesis, in Exodus chapter 3, rather, when he discloses his name to Moses. So he does say, well, I am who I am, thus you shall call me Yahweh, which means you are who you are. But in that particular context, the reason he gives for his name being called that is because he is the God who is actually with his people. So I am with my people. I will be with my people. And so that is more or less what my name means. I am who I am in the sense that I am the God who is for my people, on their side. I give them my name. I give them my promises. And because of all these things that I say, all these things that I do, all these things that I have done, on the basis of that, well, you know who I am. I am the God who brought Israel out of the land of Egypt. And implicit in that particular activity is everything we need to know about God, that he cares for his people, that he loves them, that he's faithful to his covenant, that he's not going to abandon them, that he's the God who has the power and the mercy necessary in order to accomplish that which he sets out to do for his people. So when you want to know who God is in the Old Testament, you look at what he's done. And this actually rings very true with the way that the Christian church has also expressed who God is in our creeds. It doesn't matter if you're totally looking at the Apostles' Creed, which we will look at a lot at Here We Still Stand this coming October, or at the Nicene Creed. Both of those creeds describe who God is in the persons of the Trinity by means of what they've done. I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. And I believe in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was conceived and born and suffered and died and rose again and all of this. So in each of these cases, we have God being described not in some sort of real ethereal and esoteric and mystical and abstract sort of way, but he's described most prominently by his activity. That's how we know who he is, and particularly that's how we know who he is for us. So that creedal language is rooted in the biblical language itself. When we get to know God, then we get to know him by the actions that he has performed on our behalf. And that figures here into Deuteronomy chapter 4. And that pretty much takes us through the main section of chapter 4, which ends at verse 40. The end of the chapter is... I don't exactly know why it was put here, honestly, because it's like a real jarring transition from one to the other. It ends in verse 40, talking about the land that the Lord your God is giving to you for all time. And then verse 41 transitions to something not completely distinct, but pretty distinct from what has been said before. And it's saying that Moses set apart three cities across the Jordan to the east. And these are the cities that we talked about when we covered Numbers, these cities to which a person can flee who accidentally kills one of his neighbors. So these are the cities of refuge to which that person can seek refuge and seek justice and eventually leave when the high priest dies. I suppose it's put here because there's been so much talk about the land. God's bringing you into the land. He's faithful to bring you into the land. And then Moses inserts here, oh, by the way, I know not everybody's going into the land because there are 2.5 tribes that have chosen to stay on the east side of the Jordan. So we're taking care of them too, and they're going to have their cities of refuge. So that's verses 41, 42, and 43, which we have discussed at length in the book of Numbers. Then 44 through the end of the chapter, 44 through 49 is sort of a preface, I guess you could say, to what follows. Starts out, now this is the law, literally this is the Torah. We've talked about Torah multiple times. It just means teaching. This is the teaching, the God-given word, which Moses set before the sons of Israel. These are the testimonies and the statutes and the ordinances which Moses spoke to the sons of Israel when they came out from Egypt. And then it sets the stage geographically. It says that they are across the Jordan. They're in the valley opposite Beth Peor, in the land of Sihon. Then it goes on to talk about how they took possession of the land of Og, king of Bashan, who was one of those giants. Talked about that too. And then the rest of the verses basically locate Israel on the other side of the Jordan, says specifically where they're at. So this is sort of a, this is a way in which we can envision, if you will, and then later generations of Israelites could envision exactly where Moses was speaking these words. And location matters. I mean, you see that a lot in the Bible, that location, geography is extremely significant. In the Bible, geography is theology. There are so many theological themes that are rooted in geography itself. Well, the Holy Land, for instance, but a lot of other specific locations within the Holy Land, or even a well or a field or a river or a mountain, all of these are ways in which theology is expressed geographically. And the reason the geography is so significant here is because they are literally at the brink of the promised lands. So they can more or less turn and look and see the land. They're looking at the promise that God is about to fulfill. And so while they're looking at that, Moses is going to speak to them all these words as a way of encouraging them, of reminding them, of setting before them what God has done, what he requires of them, and what he promises to do for them. And then when we jump from this into chapter 5, he's going to bring them back, bring to their remembrance what happened back when they were at Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai, when God spoke to Moses and to all Israel the Ten Commandments, or literally the Ten Words. So that takes us to the end of chapter 4. How's that? We made it. It only took us 2 episodes and 10 minutes, but we
did it. Well, I like that we are men of our word. Plowed through.
Yeah, we like to do that on occasion. Yeah, just to surprise people.
Just to surprise you. We're not always liars.
No. Just most of the time. All right. Anything you want to add? Are you ready to jump to 5?
I think I'm ready, man. I think I'm ready to do this chapter 5.
Okay, so we got a big question about chapter 5, and then we have a whole lot of little questions about chapter 5. So I'm going to throw out the big question first, and then I'm going to do a bit of introduction, and then I'm going to try and answer that big question. And as we're doing that, I want to look at a lot of little questions connected with the Ten Commandments in particular and some of the surrounding context. So here's the big question. And this has actually surprisingly been I don't want to say controversy, but at least a bit of discussion that's happened within the last year or so in Christian circles. And the bigger question, so this is not the big question I was about to ask, but the bigger question is, what connection does the Old Testament have to Christianity? You know, there was talk about our need to unattach or unhitch ourselves from the Old Testament, just kind of be New Testament kind of people. So that was a bit of a controversy. But part of that controversy that arose was, well, what relationship does the Ten Commandments have to the Christian church? So that is the big question that I'd like to ask. And I could phrase it this way. Do the Ten Commandments apply to Christians? Or do the Ten Commandments, as we have them in the Bible, in Exodus 20 and in Deuteronomy chapter 5, do these Ten Commandments apply to the Christian church? So that's the big question. And then we'll have a bunch of little questions as we work our way through this. So kind of keep that big question in your mind, and I'm gonna put forward an answer, and Dan can jump in there, and we'll see if we can work this out. Because I think it's sort of an unasked question most Christian circles. I mean, how many people have the Ten Commandments? I've been in so many homes that have the Ten Commandments on their wall, and almost always looks the same, right? It's just wooden frame, and there's a couple of gold plates, and the Ten Commandments are listed out there. Maybe you have some in your home. So, and of course, there's sometimes a push to keep up monuments to the Ten Commandments. So the question is that maybe some of you had never asked, well, do these Ten Commandments, as we have them in the Bible, are they actually applicable to us? And if so, in what way? And if no, then why are they not? So kind of keep that in the back of your mind. Let me set the stage. Deuteronomy chapter 5 opens up this way. So Moses summons all Israel, and he says, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I'm speaking today in your hearing," literally in your ears. I'm putting these words into your ears, "so that you may learn them and observe them carefully." So more or less, listen up. I've got some God words, some divine words that I'm going to be putting into your ears. So don't stop your ears, but listen, let these words have their way with you. And then Moses says something really interesting here. Verse 2, it says, "The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb." With us, he says. Verse 3, "The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, with all those of us alive here today." Now, this is fascinating. Verse 4, "The Lord spoke to you face to face at the mountain from the midst of the fire." You know, we talked a lot in chapter 4 about God speaking from the fire. Verse 5, "He did this while I was standing between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire and did not go up the mountain." So we'll stop there. Now, what's fascinating about this is because it's as if Moses is engaging in hyperbole. That's the only way that I can explain it here. That, of course, God made a covenant with the fathers and the grandfathers of the people who are standing there today. I mean, they were the ones who were actually there. But I think this is Moses' way of saying, this word that God spoke wasn't just like for that particular time and that particular generation of Israelites who were there. It was actually with us who were standing alive here today. That is who God made the covenant with. So never think in your minds that what God spoke or what God did in days of old for your fathers, your grandfathers, or for many generations ago, that was somehow not for you. One of the things that we hear frequently in the Old Testament is that everything that God did for Israelites in the past, he did for Israelites in the here and now. So for instance, in the Passover liturgy, the Israelites never speak as if God did something a long time ago for people who lived a long time ago, and we're just kind of remembering that. They always understood in their Passover liturgies that they were in Egypt, and that they were the ones who were passed over, and that they were the ones that God brought out of slavery. So God didn't just simply do this for generations long ago, but there's an understanding that everything that God did long ago, he also did for us who live in the here and now. So there is this way in which the activity of God for Israel is not temporal, not temporally binding in the sense that he only did it for one generation and not for another. So it's like this, similar to this in the case of the giving of the Ten Commandments. He didn't just give it to that particular generation that lived, that were actually standing there at the foot of Mount Sinai. He did it for this generation who's now at the brink of the Promised Land. This is like he did it for all the other generations of the Israelites who were yet to be born. All of them were standing there face to face with the Lord, hearing his words out of the midst of the fire. They to them were given the words of this covenant. Anything you want to jump in there with that, or you want me to move on?
So you keep going. I will give some thoughts on unhitching from the Old Testament.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's actually what I want to go to now. Let me use one verse as kind of a jumping off point for this discussion. So at the very end of verse 5, it said, he said, so this is about to begin the quote, and the quote begins with verse 6, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me." Okay, so we've talked about this many times before, but especially in connection with Exodus chapter 20, because this is sometimes referred to as the first word, or the not really the first commandment, but in the Jewish reckoning anyway, in the Jewish numbering of what we call the Ten Commandments, this is actually the first. And it's not even a commandment. That's one of the reasons they don't refer to these as the Ten Commandments, but they are the ten words, because the first word is actually not a description of anything required of Israel, but it's rather the description of what God did for Israel. So I am Yahweh, and Yahweh, as Yahweh, I am your God. And here's how I showed you that I am your God. I brought you up out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. So at the very beginning of these 10 words, we have nothing required of Israel. Instead, we have a declaration of the good news that the God that they claim as their God and that who claims them as his people operates in this sort of way. He goes down into the house of slavery and he declares war on the false gods who are imprisoning them, and he beats them, he destroys them, and he then brings his own people out of that house of slavery, leading them toward a land flowing with milk and honey. So that's the kind of God who's about to speak the other nine words. So the very beginning, we have a description of who this God is and what he does.
This is one of the reasons why I actually prefer the Jewish numbering of the Ten Commandments over any other numbering. So sometimes people get confused because the Reformed and broader evangelicalism has their numbering of the Ten Commandments, and then Lutherans, you know, and Catholics have their numbering, and they're like, hey, like, which of these is right? And I actually don't like either of them as well as I like the way that the Israel understood them, or Jews currently understand them even. And the reason for that is that, one, I don't view these strictly as commandments, but as you were saying, they're 10 words. And I do think that the word actually starts with the gospel before there is any kind of, hey, you know, do this and don't do this kind of stuff. But actually starts with a declarative, this is who I am and what I've done. And so that might, I don't know, that might get me in trouble with some of my Lutheran friends, but that's actually the ordering that I prefer. And the ordering that I wouldn't get into a huge argument about it, but the ordering that I actually think is correct.
It's really a strange thing, because even though they're called the 10 words more than once, never in the Bible is a number connected with any of the commandments. It's not like Paul, somewhere in Paul's epistles, he refers to the sixth commandment and he's talking about adultery, or the third commandment and he's talking about the Sabbath, or anything like that. We never have that. And there's never like a list which spells it out directly that these are the 10 words. So there's freedom for some disagreement, right?
Yeah. And I think the danger is not including this part, this declarative action, with to be part of the words. I think the numbering is irrelevant, you know, like you were saying. I mean, there's never said there could be 11, there could be 12, there could be 8. It doesn't matter. I think you do lose something if you don't include the front end. So, because usually, like you were saying, when you have like a plaque with the Ten Commandments, quote, Ten Commandments on it, this is not in them. And I think that's the thing that I would say, like, well, that's a loss a little bit. I think that would be better if it was.
Yeah, I would agree for the very reason that you specified, and also for one more reason that's connected with that, and that is that it sets the giving of the law within a narrative context. Mm-hmm. So this wasn't like the Code of Hammurabi or something, or one of the other ancient Near Eastern codes, where you just basically have all these laws listed out, which more or less, okay, the king says, these are the laws, don't do these things, or we'll chop off your arm, or we'll gouge out your eye, or we'll put you to death, or we'll do something else to you. All of those were just basically a list of laws. Like if Code of Hammurabi, for instance, was posted in public, anybody could see these laws, but they weren't any kind of narrative context. So they were just like plopped down there for the people. Do this, don't do that. Israel's laws are different. They're set within a very clear narrative context. And this narrative context, to piggyback off what you said, is a narrative context about a God whose story is a story of grace and rescue and liberation. So because of both those reasons, it sets these legal words within a narrative context, and that narrative context is full of the grace of Yahweh. I think both of those are significant for our understanding of which one of these is actually the first word that God speaks.
And I think that maybe the reason as Christians we don't we don't include that is because is interesting enough because of the very reason that you stated, which is, well, God didn't deliver me from Egypt. That was Israel. But I would actually argue, well, in as much as Christ is Israel reduced to one man, and as much as you are in Christ, the Exodus has just as much to do with you as it does with anyone else. I mean, this is, you have to view the Exodus as a gospel movement. So you are included in this. This is the move to bring about your Savior. You need Israel saved from Pharaoh. You need it. I need it. Like, we all need it, right? So I don't read this and think, oh, well, that's not about me. Any more than generations later of Israelites would read it. They're supposed to read it and see themselves there. I think as Christians, and this is part of the unhitching yourself, I think it's dangerous to do that because when even Paul talks about it, I see myself there as well. Like, this is the God who, this is my God who does these things for his people.
Yeah, and that's the reason that the gospel writers, especially Matthew and Mark, and well, I guess Luke as well, and there's hints of this in John as well, but the gospel writers put so much of an accent upon Christ fulfilling the Exodus in his life, death, and resurrection. So this is the fulfillment of the Exodus. I mean, that's why Matthew, for instance, begins his gospel with all this talk about Israel being in exile, right? They're still in exile. Even though they're on their Holy Land, they're in exile. They're waiting for the Messiah to come and to exodus them into freedom. So all the gospels, and this, of course, is found in Paul's epistles as well as in Revelation, the theme of the Exodus is pervasive throughout the Old and New Testament. And especially the second half of Isaiah talks repeatedly about the messianic salvation being an exodus event. So, yeah, God, all of this is setting the stage for that exodus that is finally going to happen in the Messiah.
Yeah, you have to view it as God delivers Israel from Egypt to save them, but also to save the world.
Yeah.
To save you and me.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it was everything that was done specifically for the nation of Israel was done with a universal purpose.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, getting back to us, what I said was the big question, do the Ten Commandments apply to us? I think for those of you who like to read Luther and who maybe have not read this particular part, check out this. You can find it online if you don't have any of the copies of Luther's works. But it's called How Christians Should Regard Moses. It's really short. I mean, I don't think... probably not 20 pages long, How Christians Should Regard Moses, in which he talks quite a bit about the church's connection with, especially with the Ten Commandments, but also with some other aspects of what he calls Moses, or really what he's referring to there are the Mosaic laws. So do the Ten Commandments apply to Christians? Well, the answer is yes and no. Because on the one hand, We'll answer the no first. On the one hand, do the Ten Commandments apply to Christians? Well, no, they don't. In this sense, that these particular laws were part of the Old Covenant, and they were given to the nation of Israel. For instance, the commandment about keeping the Sabbath is not a command that's given to Christians. In fact, we have both from the mouth of Jesus himself, as well as from the Apostle Paul, the clarity we need regarding the Sabbath, that the seventh day is no longer a day of commanded rest for Christians. So we don't live under that Old Testament law, which was part of the giving of the law to the nation of Israel. So on the one hand, the Ten Commandments, as they are, I want to be very clear here, the Ten Commandments as they are given in the context of Exodus chapter 20 and Deuteronomy chapter 5, set within the Old Covenant, stipulations and regulations that are given to the nation of Israel do not apply to the Christian church. Okay, so that's the no part. But there's also a yes here, because what we have in these laws are an explication, a making explicit of that which God has embedded into the very nature of humanity. Paul talks about this in Romans chapter 1, about how it is written on the heart or it's in the conscience, even of the Gentiles, that which God wants him to do or not to do. So we do have several of the laws that are planted in human nature that are made explicit here. For instance, about not killing and not committing adultery and not stealing and all of these universal kinds of laws that are placed within human nature, and which of course I talked about in the New Testament as well. They are made explicit in the accounts in Deuteronomy 5 and Exodus chapter 20. But the actual Ten Commandments, as we have them here, as they were given to the nation of Israel, those do not apply to Christians because that was part of the Old Covenant. But what they bear witness to are the laws which testify to our conscience and which are written on us by nature. And so to that extent, the answer is yes. So maybe you could say it better than I could, Dan, but I think that's important for us to realize, because if we don't realize that, then we do exactly what I was talking about earlier. We rip these laws out of their narrative context. And in their narrative context, they were part of the Old Covenant, which was given just to the Jews, just to the Israelites, and not intended for all times and for all places. Instead, they give expression to some of the laws, which are for all times and all places.
Yeah, well, I think, so the language that the apostles uses, particularly Paul, in reference to this sort of thing, is a language of under. So he will say, are we under the law? This is just his way of saying, does it apply in the same way? In this covenantal way, and the answer is no. His answer is no. We are no longer under the law, but under grace. And so it is impossible to read Paul and think that these things apply in exactly the same way as they did to Israel, when he explicitly says that they were under that, and we are not under that. And so we're under grace. But you do have other things where Jesus says interesting things like a new commandment I give you, love one another, this kind of thing. You have Paul say over and over again, talking about the law of liberty or the spirit of the law as opposed to the letter. And what ends up happening is that the written code of the law is done away with as something that we have to obey. So we don't have to sit here and parse through it and figure out like how to perform every aspect of this. Instead, it's sort of this, you're under grace. And because you're under grace, you are free now to love God and love neighbor. Love is at the heart of the law. And so what we've been freed to do, and as much as we've been freed to perform acts that would be in keeping with the law, is really just boiled down to what Jesus would say is love God, love your neighbor. That's sort of the spirit of the law, which is what God would have us to do. But the written law, the written letter, Paul says no, we're not under that. So yeah. We don't need to sit around thinking about the Sabbath and like make sure we've kept it and what it means to keep it, and we need to sit around and like meditate on like, well, covet, how do I parse this out, make sure I haven't done it. It's just, hey, love God and love neighbor. This is what we're after.
Not to mention the hundreds of other laws that we have, right? Dietary laws, and right. Laws of hygiene, and laws about the land, and laws about everything. You know, the hundreds upon hundreds of laws that we have outside of what we usually think about in terms of the 10 laws or the 10 words. Well, there's a bunch of others. So this is where some churches go astray in the sense that they're wanting to maintain a commitment to all of the Old Testament laws as still applicable in the Christian life today. And what happens when that takes place is that it still keeps people under the law, and it also denigrates that completion work that Christ has done. So I mean, we have it explicit in the New Testament. Christ is the end of the law. So he has fulfilled all of this. And so for us to still be under some kind of law about keeping the Sabbath, or under some kind of law about what we can and can't eat, or under some law about what we can or can't wear, or some law about whether we have to be circumcised or not circumcised, or any of these other laws that were given explicit to the Israelites, we aren't under those anymore. We are free from those. They've been fulfilled in Christ, as have all the other laws as well. So in him, we're free. And in that freedom, we live in the law in the sense that we live in love for our neighbor and in love for our God. And it's on those two commandments that the New Testament says hung all of the law and the prophets.
Yeah, and by end of the law, some people, you know, I've said this before and had the objection. Well, I mean, Jesus says, you know, he didn't come to abolish the law. Are you saying that he abolished the law? I'm like, no. Like, I don't mean end in that way. That's not what it means. It means end as in Jesus was the thing that the law was trying to get you to. He was the goal. The goal of the law was to get you to Christ. It still is. You're supposed to hear the law. If you hear it and you feel condemned, it's supposed to get you to Jesus. But once you get to Jesus, Jesus is not trying to turn you back around and have you start marching in the opposite direction from which you just came. This is not how this is supposed to work. So the law drives you to Christ, and Christ then does not drive you back to the law. Christ is the end game. Like, that's once you get to Christ, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, if you want an illustration of what happens in churches when Christ is portrayed as someone that drives you back under the law, we'll just read Galatians sometimes. And notice how heated the Apostle Paul gets there.
Right.
And I don't know of any other place in the New Testament where he is so irate. I mean, this is truly righteous anger on the part of Paul, where he is angry because what has happened is he goes in, he plants this church, he gets everything just right, he preaches them the pure, unadulterated gospel, and he's barely out of town before people start coming in, the Judaizers. And they start saying, well, yeah, the gospel's great, but we also need to keep the law. We also need to bring you back under the law. So Paul writes this letter in which he is just fuming. It's the ink on the pages of Galatians is steaming. He is so angry. And rightly so. He's angry in the same way that I would be angry if I was a pastor of a church and I took a 6-month sabbatical and someone filled in for me and I came back and all of a sudden people are saying, Jesus plus something else is what we need to do.
Yeah.
I'd preach like a series of 500 sermons against that.
Yeah.
I would do my own kind of Galatians preaching. Yeah.
Yeah. Because
what happens is if we lose the gospel, we lose everything. And that's what was happening in Galatians.
And this is why the answer of like, should we unhitch ourselves from the Old Testament is no, because you do not want to cut yourself off from the thing that drives you to Christ. That would be a mistake.
Absolutely. Not to mention the fact that the Old Testament is just overflowing with promises about the Messiah. So you've got both of them. You've got law gospel. It's not like Old Testament law, New Testament gospel. It's scattered throughout the scriptures. And so the law in the Old Testament serves its purpose to drive us to Christ. And the gospel in the Old Testament serves its purpose also to give us Christ and the good news and all the mercy and freedom that we have in him.
Well, I mean, I know that Old Testament is in the title and you know New Testament is in the title of the other podcast, but that's just because that we did that for you, listener, because that's how you're used to hearing it. The reality is this is all just one collection of a bunch of books, and Old and New Testament are a little bit manufactured. There's a big gap. You know, you have the silent period in between, and yes, you have Christ saying this is the New Testament in my blood and this sort of thing. The idea that you could just like cut the book in half and get rid of part of it does extreme violence to the grand narrative that God is trying to put on display for us, of extreme violence to it. The New Testament makes zero sense without the Old Testament. Not for one of the simple reasons it makes zero sense is that these guys quote the Old Testament. You have no idea what they're quoting from, and they're quoting it authoritatively. It would make no sense at all. I mean, so that's like that's a very basic reason why it doesn't make any sense to cut it off. But also, you don't know how we got here. The Gospels don't make sense apart from the Old Testament. You don't know what's going on.
Yeah, it's like reading, you know, some 500-page novel about this great story, but you only try and read the last half of the last chapter and think that you're going to know what's going on.
Yeah.
You don't know the characters. You don't know the storyline. You don't know everything's been leading up to this point. So that would be like reading the New Testament without the Old. And which is why I think it's a great idea to have a podcast about the Old Testament.
That's right. Yeah, as we got here. All right, guys, that's it. You know what? We got through chapter 4. We're up in that chapter 5. Guys, if you want to support the idea that we should go through the Old Testament, you can do that by going over to the donate button on any of the sites, 1517, Christ Fast, it all goes to the same place. You can click on that, become a supporter. It helps us out, keeps everything free. And if you're one of the people that do that, thank you very much. Chad, I will see you in Des Moines this weekend.
Head to the Midwest. See you there.